White Hot Magazine of Contemporary Art. Auction house specialist David Norman joins us today from New York City. David is a specialist in modern art, and his field is actually impressionist and modern art, and he was at Sotheby's. He became director of the Department of Impressionist and Modern Art at Sotheby's in 1999, and a worldwide chairman for the division in 2008, and then a vice chairman of Sotheby's North American. From 2019 to 2022, David was chairman of Phillips Auction House in America. David directed sales of artworks from such institutions as the Museum of Modern Art, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum, Museum of Fine Arts Boston, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, as well as numerous other public and private foundations. In the early 1990s, David pioneered and directed Sotheby's first sales of 20th century German art, staging the first international auction in the then unified city of Berlin. In 2004, David oversaw the auction of the first painting to ever break the $100 million barrier, Pablo Picasso's Garçon à la Pipe. I think that's how you pronounce it in French. Send me an email if that's wrong. In 2010, he curated Sotheby's first private selling exhibition of modern art in Hong Kong and Beijing. Under his leadership and tenure, Sotheby's not only sold the first $100 million painting, but also the first sculpture to exceed $100 million, Giacometti's Walking Man, and the first work on paper to pass that same mark, Edvard Munch's The Scream. Edvard Munch. See, I got that right. I love Edvard Munch. In 2017, David acquired an early pointillist painting for the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam. As a leading industry expert, David has been frequently quoted in publications such as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg Art News, and Art at Auction magazine. He has appeared on television networks such as CNBC and foreign outlets including CNN Asia, podcasts, interviews for the Financial Times, China, and is a frequent contributor of articles for several online journals. One of the most recognized auction experts in the field of Impressionist and modern art, and a trusted advisor to private collectors for over 35 years, David Norman launched David Norman Fine Art LLC to continue to advise and assist individuals and institutions worldwide. Please welcome David Norman. Today on the White Hot Magazine Art World Podcast, and I'm your host, Noah Becker. Hi, David. Welcome to the White Hot Magazine Art World Podcast. Welcome. Is that the best way to welcome a person?
I think so. Okay. It's always appreciated. Good. I'm very good. Thank you.
Good. And you're currently on the Upper East Side in Manhattan?
Yes, I am.
For the listeners to know where you are. And so for the people listening in, I'm assuming I might do a little bit of an intro, but you have been working in auction houses and contemporary art in a big way for a long time now. And you began your career in 1985 as a specialist in the field of Impressionist and modern art at Sotheby's. Can you talk about just sort of the beginnings, like what your life was like then and how you got involved?
Oh, sure. And actually my field has always and really still is Impressionist and modern, which is, you know, I kind of go up to artists who began their career before World War II. So in my category, which is sort of a sort of created auction category, modern means you know, I'll handle a 1971 Picasso, but not a 1958 de Kooning, you know. So mm-hmm. once you go New York School forward, that's out of my specialty field in terms of my auction career. But I graduated back in 82, an art history major. And it was a very different time for getting a job. I walked around Soho, and that's where the galleries mostly were at the time, handing out resumes. I did internships, you know, places like the New Museum, anywhere I could just get any kind of foot in the door, whether it be helping with an exhibition or painting gallery walls overnight, you know, with friends who worked at the galleries. And around 85, I saw an ad in the New York Times, which is the way we did it. And I was sent to take a typing test. I took a test. They sent the results to Sotheby's. I had no idea what auction house I was applying for. And I went there in the role of, if I could put this clearly, the temp of the secretary of the man whose position I held when I left. So I was hired during one of the biggest sales of the 80s, a collection from the estate of Florence Gould. It had Van Gogh's and great impressionist works. And so I was hired by Sotheby's to just be sort of a temp extra help for it. And when I got into the company, and I just felt I was in the right place and just was excited about everything, and you know, moved from doing some admin help quickly to doing research and writing about the artworks. That moves into learning how to do the valuations, put the sales together, work with the clients. And then it was just a progression. And when I left in 2016, I was the chairman for the division worldwide.
Right. So you became the chairman, worldwide chairman for the division in 2008. The vice chairman of Sotheby's North America. Right? Is that what it?
Yeah, you know, it's that's you know.
Titles.
Hey, at some point they just give you titles.
Yeah, right.
They're not always descriptive of any particular function or anything to serve.
Right.
Up,
and so what? What moved you from what moved you from Christie's to
Sotheby's? Yeah.
Yeah.
Sotheby's
to Phillips. That's what
right.
I
Well, saying. There was an interim step. It was 2016, and there was a moment where Sotheby's was being taken privately. I mean, it was purchased by the collector and hedge fund, Dan Loeb. And at the same time, there was this offer of sort of exit packages. And I was one of quite a lot of people who kind of took advantage of it. I had always, thought that one day I would work privately. The auction schedule could sometimes be a punishing one. And so I took them up on it. From 2016 to 19, I worked on my own as a private dealer, brokering transactions, and at least half of my time was also spent being an advisor, helping people, pick an auction house to sell their collections. Something I enjoyed enormously and have returned to. And around the time I was working on my own, Phillips Auction House asked me if I would consult for them. You know, when they had early 20th century material and they wanted some additional expertise, I would, lend a hand to help them with valuation, sometimes join them to make presentations for clients considering selling. And it's a great place. And it was filled with a lot of my friends who also used to work at Sotheby's. So it just felt like a great thing to join a group again in 2019, because I didn't feel I was quite ready to be completely on my own. It was a wonderful experience. COVID hit immediately. So even though I was thinking I'll you know, I'd like to go back and be amongst a team of people, not isolated in my home office. We all ended up being isolated, but the experience was still great. And it was, you know, working collaboratively. You know.
So can you kind of talk about some of the basic differences between Sotheby's and Phillips?
Yeah, the I mean, Sotheby's and Christie's, you know, are obviously these, you know, big institutions that are selling in scores of categories. I don't know how many tens of different categories of sales each house has, from, you know, collectibles, furniture, all types of things, into many different periods of fine art. Phillips is focused purely on 20th and 21st century art in, I think it's six different collecting categories, you know, fine art, 20th century design, prints and graphics, photographs. Of the three auction houses, they're the leaders in watches, extraordinary. And jewelry. So it's you know, I don't know of a different word to use other than maybe you'd think of it as like a boutique auction house, really very focused on just art of the last century, with a special sort of position with very young art and bringing artists for the first time to the secondary market at auction, which Christie's and Sotheby's has been following suit, but Phillips has a great reputation for sort of introducing a lot of these young artists to the auction market for the first time. So it's, you know, it's a two-century-old place, just like Sotheby's and Christie's, but it's got a very sort of young vibe and a real focus on this very specific, you know, period of collecting.
And then you've been directing sales between institutions and auction houses for many years. Is the dynamic with that more or less working with collections of like older or deceased collectors that are then donating works to museums, or how does the interaction work when you're directing sales from places like Museum of Modern Art or the Guggenheim?
Sure. And there are two different things when the, in this country in particular, if a, you know, individual dies with a very valuable art collection, you know, they'll either, you know, there'll be a donation to a museum, but more often the case, the collection gets sold. And the, you know, the heirs, it's very hard for families to retain the art collections with the value and all the taxes due. So the estate will sell the collection. And when we work with museums, it's more a matter of the museums going through their continuous review, you know, of their holdings and thinking about, you know, some pieces that they consider, you know, kind of appropriate for sale to raise funds to make acquisitions. So when I've worked with, you know, so many of the major institutions, they've been deaccessioning, you know, to earmark the funds for purchases. And it really hasn't been a case where the collector passes away, donates, and then the institution is the seller. So they're different, you know, there are different types of sales. And then the experience differs, you know, you interject any questions. I mean, with the museum, you're working with curators, so you're working with, you know, art historians and professionals, which I enjoy enormously. And, you know, boards that the curators need to go to make their case for the deaccession and the values and, you know, the choices. When you are working for a family, you know, either to sell their parents' estate or you're working for the individuals who may be selling their art or their collections in their lifetime, which of course happens too, you know, then there's a very personal aspect, a more intimate aspect to it, because you're dealing directly with the individual who is sort of devoted years of their life and their resources into creating something they really loved. And, you know, if it's in their lifetime, you work closely with them about it in the presentation. If they passed away, you work with the family to, you know, not just sell the art to its greatest, but to, you know, create a fitting memorial to their parents and the collection they built.
Right.
You know, it's both the interactions are different, and also the way you go about, you know, marketing a collection varies. Some private families or private individuals don't want to be named, and so therefore the story doesn't come into a part of it, or the biography of the collector isn't a part of it, and you're focused purely on marketing the artwork exclusively on its own merits, not necessarily by association with a collector or collection or an era.
Mm-hmm. So then when you broke the $100 million barrier selling the famous Picasso picture, how did that come into the auction house, and how did you get involved in that sale?
Well, that painting had been in the Whitney family collection, the great, beginning with Jock Whitney, the great, you know, family. So much of the art is in museums, you know, here, and great fortune, the Whitneys. And we always, you know, were aware that work, the foundation may sell it one day, that it wasn't earmarked for museum donation. And everybody was sort of waiting for the first artwork, the first painting to make $100 million. And we always sort of kept close, you know, the foundation and the family. And, you know, we always believed, you know, whenever this may come into play to compete for it against Christie's, whoever wins might be the people to sell the first
right.
100.
But what is that competition like? How is that competition waged?
It's a pretty complex one, because first, it's an entire, in this instance, so you have an entire collection. You you know, come up with a, you know, very elaborate, comprehensive marketing plan. You provide valuations of all the artworks, and then you provide, you know, financial proposals, and the proposals, you know, will come either in one or both forms, being a guaranteed price to the seller or the entity selling. They'll get a certain minimum, and above that minimum, there will be certain commissions and earnings to the auction house, or no guarantee on the collection and just trying to, you know, give them the best net they can get. But usually whenever it's an estate or a museum selling, for most part, you have to offer a guarantee. And then that's a big commitment. That's a huge commitment on the auction house, you know, to basically, you know, underwrite back the sale. And so you're competing with, in that instance, Sotheby's with Christie's, as is often the case. And internally, the staff is, you know, assigning the value. You're, you know, trying to game out the possible, you know, outcomes. Work with management as to, you know, how much risk are you able to take? How far, how high a guarantee will you offer, you know? And what will you charge the seller for that guarantee? And, you know, when it's something that prized, you push hard, because it's, you know, the potential earnings, but it's also, you know, the market share, the press, you know, so to speak, the glory, you know, of having a real landmark masterwork and masterpiece collection. So it's a very, very intense process. Oftentimes the entire collection gets cataloged, and you present the sellers with a mock-up of how it will look. You mock up all the advertising. You do a tremendous amount of work, you know, on spec, you know, but you want to show exactly the kind of product you'll make. And it's a huge effort. It's finance people, it's art and design people in-house, it's writers, it's researchers. You're almost fully cataloging the collection and valuing it in order to make your presentation. So if you win, then it just all rolls out from there. If you don't win, you know, you've invested a lot of time, a lot of expense in doing it, but that's the game.
Was there a public buyer for that Picasso for $100 million? I don't remember.
No, the name was never known.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, when I started in 85, 86, the market was waiting for the first $10 million picture. That hadn't happened yet.
Right.
I think it was finally maybe in 1986, an old master painting by Montaigne that made 10. It was the first.
Right. So can I ask, where does the painting go, the Picasso, after it sells for $100 million and nobody knows who bought it? Does it disappear into the buyer's warehouse? Or,
I mean, people do, you know, it's, people live with the pictures. For the most part, people, you know, are living with the artworks. Almost all the major works I've handled are, you know, in the homes, you know, of collectors. Many, it's so nice, will be gifted to museums. There'll be bequests. I think sometimes people do, you know, things might have moments in storage. When somebody spends, you know, sometimes it's known, not often, but sometimes it's known who the buyer is. They're very public people. But most of the time, when someone's spending that kind of money, you know, and they aren't necessarily a well-known household name in the art market and financial worlds, and, you know, then, you know, people understandably want their privacy and their sort of security. Someone knowing what's being delivered to the house, in that truck the next day.
I'm just saying, it's not like Raiders of the Lost Ark or something where there's this giant warehouse and things just disappear. Like if somebody bought the Mona Lisa or something like that, like there would be some kind of public need for the painting to either be displayed or its whereabouts kind of known.
Well, I mean, no, that's not the case, because there are, unless I misunderstood you, they're free ports, you know, everywhere, Singapore, Geneva, Delaware. I mean, there are a lot of very valuable artworks that are in storage, very valuable. So I don't know if maybe there's a Raiders of the Lost Ark aspect, because people live in different places and sometimes artworks will be, you know, deposited somewhere at a period of time. There's certainly big things that come through the public sales that will spend some of their lives in storage.
Right.
But, you know, there's also plenty that go to homes or that the owners lend to museums and exhibitions. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't quite say like the auction houses facilitate these huge sales and then the artworks are gone forever.
Yeah. I was just curious. Then around 6 years after this $100 million Picasso sale, you curated Sotheby's first private selling exhibition of modern art in Hong Kong and Beijing.
Right.
That must have been kind of intense.
That was exciting, and that was fun, and that was there are these moments in the market where sort of new buying groups, you know, sort of start to arise, usually in different parts of the world. When I joined, buyers in Japan were the overwhelming force in the art world, really pushing prices in the late 80s. You know, it's always an international market, but the Japanese buyers were really, you know, so, had such power in the market, were doing so much of the purchasing.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And so that when the Japanese withdrew, when there was a recession, a real estate bubble burst and they withdrew, the whole market contracted. The art market really suffered for it. And, you know, around that time of that exhibition, there was increasing interest coming out of China, you know, proper mainland, you know, as well as continuing to develop in Taiwan and Hong Kong. And that was starting to become a bigger and bigger part of the, you know, the buying base for the auctions. You know, there was also a period, short-lived, where the Russians had a great deal of influence. There's a period where the Middle East, and it continues to, as, you know, Qatar and the Louvre Abu Dhabi, as they're doing buying, they've become a big constituency in terms of, you know, purchases in the art market. In the US, it was the rise of the hedge fund managers that became a very significant group. But at that time, we were very much seeing the beginnings and eagerly trying to develop the international auction trade in China and with Chinese national buyers. So that was fun. And it was, it certainly proved to be right. And, you know, buyers from mainland and in their surrounding regions, you know, started to become, I think for the last few years, you know, even the second most powerful buying group after the Americans, and surpassed Europeans in terms of the total value of works purchased at auction. So that was exciting, you know, bringing artworks there and, you know, watching that sort of market develop, you know, as wealth kind of explodes in different parts of the world. What will follow is a certain, what happens is the wealth is generated. The individuals will frequently buy their own patrimony. They'll buy their own national art. And then, you know, there'll be a segment at the top that is, you know, very international looking, and they'll start having homes in different places, and they'll start forming art collections, sort of joining a more global world of, you know, ultra high wealth individuals. And Western European 19th and 20th century art, you know, and just always ends up being of appeal. Again, whether it's in Asia, South America, Russia, certainly the US and Europe always. So the field I've worked in has always been, you know, in demand.
So let's talk about the first $100 million sculpture, or to exceed $100 million, Giacometti's Walking Man, that you were part of, and the Edvard Munch, The Scream, you were also part of that. So let's talk about that quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun, the fact that I was, you know, able to be there when, you know, all three of the major mediums artists executed their art and reached that mark. You know, sculpture had always been, like before me and just as I joined, relatively much lower value than the paintings and the works on paper, the unique art, the unique pieces. And I, because sculptures were always cast in editions, and, you know, they just sort of were, even if it was Picasso, Giacometti, the great, you know, artists, their sculpture tended to not really match the levels of what their paintings made. But, you know, like is often the case in the art world and anything where there's this idea of supply and demand and scarcity and rising prices, the market, collectors, people look for where, you know, there's great quality. As the greatest paintings became more scarce, you know, certainly the greatest achievements in sculpture, you know, are no less important, no less historic. And therefore, you would see the demand rise and more people, you know, get more seriously into buying sculpture. And I think that was the signal, you know, that, you know, that was the case. And also that, you know, establishing Giacometti really sitting atop, you know, kind of the pyramid in terms of valuable, you know, sculptors. I mean, a great Brancusi's are you know, worth a fortune and could be more than a Giacometti, but they're so rare. There was never enough, really much of a supply necessarily to firmly establish a demonstrable market. So then Giacometti, you know, when it came up, it was, even though they're all editions, you know, numbered editions of six and then additional casts, it was such a landmark artwork of the 20th century. There was no hesitation, you know, in chasing it. And the Ed van Bunk, the screen really was the same thing. And that, I mean, the Giacometti Walking Man was one of the classic, you know, key subjects and images of his art, but it wasn't the singularly only image for Giacometti. There's the standing women, there's, you know, groupings of figures. But for Munch, the scream is the single greatest image known of his body of work. And I think we knew at the time after the Mona Lisa, the most famous image, most recognized image of Western art in the world. Right. So when the owner decided to, it was time to sell that was a pretty thrilling moment. We thought, just like we had with the Picasso boy with the pipe, the painting that made 100, the Giacometti Walking Man, we thought if there's going to be something executed on paper that's going to make that much, it will be this. And again, in the hierarchy of medium, drawings were, you know, always the lowest. You know, it would be given the same artist, it would be paintings, it might be sculpture, then you'd have colored works on paper, watercolors. Less valuable would be inks and charcoals, less valuable would be pencils. There was a sort of hierarchy of medium. But, you know, when you got down to basically one of the one or two most famous images of Western art, and of the four versions he created of the scream, it was the only one in private hands still. The other three were in Oslo, in the Munch Museum and the National Museum. That was a really exciting, you know, opportunity to work on that. And it was pretty thrilling. And it was, in this instance, it was reported at the time that the collector and financier, Leon Black, was the purchaser, and he put it on loan to MoMA for a period of time. So, you know, there's a perfect example of, you know, these great artworks don't sort of disappear forever into sort of the lairs of some kind of Dr. No or, you know, whatever that, you know, it was publicly known, and it's, you know, it's been publicly seen. So, you know, the art loving world wasn't deprived of the, you know, chance to see the piece.
Now, what do you have coming up?
Well, now that I've left Phillips at the end of June, so I've returned to working privately. And so my work is a sort of an ongoing project. I'm selling pieces, and coming this fall, I'll be advising a few different collectors. And in the process of, you know, receiving and weighing proposals from the auction houses. So I'm back out on my own. I had a wonderful 3 years at Phillips, but at this point in my life, I decided I finally was ready to, you know, kind of exit the intensity of the auction game and just kind of do things on my own schedule. So it's fortunate for that.
That's great. Well, I look forward to connecting with you soon. And I hope you have a great rest of, where are we now? Mid-September?
Yeah, we're even coming toward the end of it. So
Right. Okay, well, thanks for sharing your stories. And it's great to connect with you. And let's be in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I enjoyed this.
All right.
It's been terrific to meet you.
All right.
Look forward to it.
Take care, man.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.